The online activist, Democratic, and hacker communities were shocked when they learned about Aaron Swartz's suicide last year. He took his own life after spending 2 years defending himself in a federal criminal case for downloading academic files that he believed should be free and open for all. The question is, why did the government crack down so hard? Aaron Swartz was just 26. He faced 13 felonies and 35 years in jail. What does his case reveal about the future fight for the free flow of information? Today, we're rebroadcasting a conversation we had with Brian Knappenberger, director of The Internet's Own Boy, a documentary about Aaron Swartz. Join us after the news.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. Israeli police have clashed with Palestinian protesters in East Jerusalem during the funeral of a local Palestinian teenager who was murdered earlier this week. The boy's family believe he was killed in a revenge attack for the kidnapping and killing of three young Israelis last month. From East Jerusalem, here's Yonan Nell.
A crowd carried the body of 17-year-old Mohammed Abu Khader through the street wrapped in a Palestinian flag. After prayers by the mosque next to his family home, he was taken in a casket to a nearby cemetery. Young Palestinians then threw rocks at Israeli police officers, who responded with stun grenades. Palestinians accuse Israeli extremists of killing the teenager in a revenge attack for the killing of three young Israelis. The Israeli police say they're still investigating.
A senior Hamas official in Gaza has contacted the BBC to clarify reports that a ceasefire with Israel is imminent. Over the past week, the Israeli Air Force has responded to rocket attacks from Gaza with attacks on training facilities used by militant organizations. The Hamas official said no ceasefire had been agreed yet, but acknowledged contacts. The Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has said that he will never give up his candidacy for the post of Prime Minister. It comes amid continuing pressure, both inside and outside Iraq, for him to step down. Mr. Maliki's alliance of parties won the largest number of seats in the recent general election. Andrew Hoskin reports from Baghdad.
In a defiant statement read out on state television by an announcer, Mr. al-Maliki vowed to continue his quest for a third term as Iraq's prime minister, in the face of growing criticism to his eight-year rule, not least from other Shia figures. "I will never give up my candidacy for the post of prime minister," Mr. al-Maliki stated emphatically. "I will remain a soldier, defending the interests of the people of Iraq," he said. The statement comes after a chaotic opening of Iraq's parliament earlier this week, caused in large part by the growing political crisis over the alleged sectarian nature of Mr. al-Maliki's Shia-dominated government.
The Nigerian military says it's arrested three women accused of recruiting female members for the Islamist group Boko Haram. Last month, for the first time, a female suicide bomber tried to blow up a military barracks in northern Nigeria. Will Ross reports from Lagos.
The three suspects were, according to the military, recruiting other women, especially widows and young girls, into Boko Haram. A statement from the Ministry of Defence says Hafsat Usman Bako, Zainab Idris and Aisha Abubakar were enticing them with the promise of marriage to members of Boko Haram. For years, the Islamist extremist group has benefited from a degree of support from some men and women living in villages and cities in northern Nigeria. And women have been detained before following mass arrests in cities like Maiduguri. But now it seems there are efforts to get women to play a more active role in the insurgency.
Will Ross reporting. World News from the BBC. The Australian entertainer Rolf Harris has been jailed for 5 years and 9 months for indecently assaulting four girls. The judge in London said Harris, who presented children's TV programmes in Britain for nearly half a century, had taken advantage of the trust placed in him. He said the 84-year-old had shown no remorse and his reputation lay in ruins. One of his victims was a childhood friend of his daughter. Legal officials say they're considering whether the sentence was unduly lenient. Police in Macedonia have fired tear gas, water cannon and stun grenades to disperse an angry demonstration against the jailing of six ethnic Albanians for murder and terrorism. Several thousand ethnic Albanians took to the streets to protest at the life sentences handed down for the killing of five Macedonians at a lake near Skopje 2 years ago. The authorities described the defendants as followers of radical Islam. Queen Elizabeth has officially given her name to the largest warship ever built in Britain in a ceremony at Rosyth Dockyard in Scotland. The 65,000-ton aircraft carrier was launched with a bottle of Scotch whisky instead of the traditional champagne. The carrier is the first of two being built for the Royal Navy at a cost of more than $10 billion. Colin Blaine reports.
The Queen named this huge aircraft carrier under the grey skies of the River Forth, watched by hundreds of shipyard workers and their families. It is a day of celebration for them. It's taken 5 years to build HMS Queen Elizabeth, and she's not likely to be fully operational until 2020. The decision to equip the Royal Navy with two carriers, a sister ship is under construction, has been hugely controversial.
In the Football World Cup in Brazil, France are taking on Germany in the quarter-final in Rio de Janeiro, with the Germans leading 1-0 at half-time. Later, in a highly anticipated South American duel, the hosts Brazil play Colombia. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The new documentary, The Internet's Own Boy, directed by today's guest, Brian Knappenberger, is a powerful film about the young internet prodigy Aaron Swartz. He was a strong believer in the free flow of information for all. Aaron committed suicide last year amidst intense pressure from a criminal case brought against him by the U.S. government. He was just 26 years old. He was charged with 13 felonies and a possible 35-year prison sentence related to stealing academic files from the online JSTOR via the school library at MIT. The case was left unresolved, and his motive was never fully known. And so many people around Aaron are asking why. Why did the government decide to crack down so hard? Aaron's friends, family, colleagues, and supporters understand this act in the context of his life's work, which was, above all, about increasing access to knowledge and information. In the film, Aaron's friend and former partner Quinn Norton said, quote, "He was the internet's own boy, and the old world killed him," end quote. The Internet's Own Boy will be screening as part of the San Francisco Doc Fest tonight at 7 p.m. and tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the Roxy in San Francisco in the Mission District, and it'll screen again at the Roxy on July 4th. And you can find more information about the screenings at yourcallradio.org. Today we are joined by Brian Knappenberger. He's an award-winning investigative documentary filmmaker and director of The Internet's Own Boy. Brian also directed the recent award-winning independent feature We Are Legion, The Story of Hacktivist. It explored the online hacktivist group Anonymous and chronicled a year of unprecedented online protest activity. Brian's work often centers on technology, its possibilities, and the transformative effect it has on our lives and culture. Brian's in town for the San Francisco Indie Doc Fest, and he joins me here in studio. Hi, Brian. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Parker Higgins, an activist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, where he specializes in freedom of speech and copyright, trademark, and patent law. Parker knew and worked with Aaron on fighting SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, in 2012. Hi, Parker. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So, Brian, this was a really amazing film. I'm so glad you made this. When did you first learn about Aaron Swartz?
Well, I was aware of Aaron from his first arrest, when he was first arrested, and his sort of legal troubles began. But at the time, I think that's primarily because I was following lots of hacktivist activity, particularly people who had kind of run afoul of the law in some ways. And it struck me that not a lot of people knew about his case or were following it. This was a two-year legal nightmare. And there's been lots of other cases and lots of other hackers that have gotten a lot more attention for their legal troubles. But I was on a panel talking about hackers and hacktivism with Quinn Norton about a week after Aaron died at a symposium in New York. And it seemed, you know, it was a very, very somber affair. And everybody there seemed to have a story about Aaron. So I started filming about a week after Aaron chose to take his own life. And, you know, trying to understand this kind of wave of sympathy and anger and frustration that was happening and why his story resonated with so many people. And that's essentially when this documentary began.
We did a show after Aaron took his own life about what he believed in, access to information, why it is so expensive, and we'll talk about that today. But you also point out that
Aaron's story really didn't get that much media attention until after he took his own life, even though the government was cracking down so hard for simply downloading files. I mean, he faced 13 felonies and up to 35 years in prison.
Yeah, and I actually didn't learn until I started making the documentary why that was. He was actively trying to keep it quiet. He didn't want to bring his friends into this awful kind of legal situation he was in, so he didn't talk about it with people very much. And he didn't want to anger the prosecutors. There's a point in the film that we point out that he, at one point, he released, does a press release essentially talking about his case through a group that he co-founded called Demand Progress. And it was just a press release, but later a report done by MIT said that the prosecutors saw it as a wild internet campaign. I mean, I've made two films now about hacktivism and online protest, and I can attest that it was not a wild internet campaign. I've seen some wild internet campaigns.
A wild internet campaign?
Yeah, so that's evidence that, you know, they really kind of cracked down on him talking about it. And so I think that's why it wasn't well known before he died.
The other thing that I love about the film is you start in the beginning with Aaron as a child. I mean, he was so bright, reading at the age of 3. He was introduced to computers at age 3. He started programming at a young age. When he was 12, this is really interesting, he made a website called The Info, The Way You Want the Web to Be, where people could fill in information, share knowledge with us. He did this all by himself in his room.
Yeah.
And it's just like Wikipedia.
Yeah, it's an early version of Wikipedia.
He was only 12 years old when he did this.
Yeah, I know somebody who studies, actually, that's what they study, versions of Wikipedia. And they said Aaron's was pretty great, actually. Yeah, I mean, he was remarkable, and I think one of the aspects of the internet and internet communities is the classic, you know, on the internet nobody knows you're a dog, like the classic New Yorker cartoon. On the internet, Aaron was working with a lot of these kind of groups that were kind of coming up with the kind of early standards of the web, and he was holding his own in such a way that I think he was, you know, really treated as a colleague, and people were, and this is a kind of funny part of the film, actually, people were genuinely kind of surprised to learn that this colleague that they were working with was 13 years old.
Right, because a lot of the dialogue took place online.
Yeah.
And they said, we want you to come to our conference, and he said, I don't think my mom will let me.
Exactly.
Because he's only 13.
Exactly.
Parker, I hear you laughing in the background. Talk a little bit about, you know, what you think we need to know about who Aaron was. And I mean, it was just amazing that he helped build the plumbing for modern hypertext. So this is the tool that you use to get summaries of what's going on websites. He was only 13 when he did this. This RSS, I'm sure a lot of people listening use this. But it's just amazing to see all the things he did at such a young age.
Absolutely. And that's so when we talk about what sort of the story of Aaron inspires us to do, some of it is advancing the things that he cared most about, and that's access to information and that sort of thing. But then also, when you look at that biography and you think about what we could have done, what we could have gotten if we had had Aaron for 50 more years, you think really the cost of having these computer crime laws that are so draconian and so depend on prosecutorial discretion. And that really inspires us to want to change that and think about what we could have had and what we could get out of this.
Yeah, I would totally underscore that. The one particularly kind of, I found it almost haunting part of the film when we were making it was coming across archival footage of Aaron talking about NSA overreach, government overreach in terms of spying and snooping, and he was, the footage when we dated it was a year before Snowden came forward. And so we play it in the film, and he's talking about how we kind of were learning things about it, but we're not angry about it because it was this slow kind of progress in which this was kind of creeping into our modern life, and there was never a kind of galvanizing moment that really turned the tide and made us upset about this as a culture. And the truth is, he just never lived to see that moment. And you can't help but wonder what kind of a warrior he would have in that battle now.
Right, because not only did he was a huge champion for the free flow of information, but he also became a very strong and effective political organizer.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting because a lot of people in the film say this sort of counters Silicon Valley. I mean, Aaron Swartz was not interested in making a lot of money, and he could have. I mean, he did make money off of
sale to Condé Nast
of Reddit for about $1 million. But that wasn't his end goal. I mean, his end goal was about sharing information. So I thought that was really interesting. That really didn't come out in the media coverage after his death. Can you talk about that also,
Yeah,
Brian?
I mean, you know, the sale of Reddit to Condé Nast made him a very rich 19-year-old. And I think what he does there says a lot about him and is really interesting. He really turns his back on kind of traditional Silicon Valley startup culture. I think, you know, reading through his blogs, reading through some of the things he was thinking about at the time, I mean, he really kind of wanted to, he saw Silicon Valley as a kind of machine for making money. And the notion that, oh, you're going to make the world a better place is kind of a cliche, kind of an absurd cliche that his kind of level of intellectual curiosity could kind of see through. And so he's really started asking his questions. Well, do you really want to make the world a better place? Mm. Do you know what makes the world bad to begin with? Do you know what your actions, what kind of effect your actions are going to take? And then can you measure that effect? And if you're really serious about it, you'd be kind of doing all these things at that level. And so I think after that, he took a very sort of decisive turn towards social justice issues, political organizing, that sort of thing, and putting his skills in the public interest. It's a really interesting there's a clip in the film where he talks about if you think you can actually do something that makes a difference. I mean, what's your excuse for not doing that?
Parker, can you also tell us a little bit more about that, about how Aaron used technology to raise awareness about political issues and his hopes for making the world a better place?
Absolutely. When you look at a lot of his writing, he was a very prolific writer, and he kept a blog where he journaled, but also laid out these like political statements and such. Really, the themes that run through it are curiosity, like that people should want to explore this and think about what they can do to make the world a better place, and just the idea that you see that with programmers sometimes, that that programmers are very interested in figuring out exactly how a computer program or something like that works, and he just applied that same curiosity to everything. And he read about he would read not just technical stuff. He would read histories and books about politics and activism. And so really you see that run through a lot of his writing. And even if he wasn't, we know that he was a prodigy who wrote this really incredible software. But at the same time, his writing about, you know, activists focusing on theories of change and what exactly you can do, it's really important stuff that would be good to read from anybody. Hmm. And then you find out that it's from this guy who was really working to make that happen in a very low computer level.
He looked up to Tim Berners-Lee,
yeah,
who is often called the father.
He's essentially the inventor.
The inventor
of the
World Wide Web.
Yeah.
Right. And Tim Berners-Lee, again, instead of profiting from all of this and, you know, making it private, depending on who bought it, he decided to give it away.
Yeah.
He didn't want to cash out. He wanted everyone to have access to the web. So we have him to thank. And, you know, so many others, obviously. But that's – Aaron sort of emulated that.
I think that is the spirit that Aaron came from. And I think Tim Berners-Lee was a big influence on him. I mean, Tim Berners-Lee recognized that he had something incredible, but really the only way it was going to work – I mean, there's plenty of ways I think he could have profited from it. But really the only way it was going to work is if there was one worldwide web and not sort of separate sort of, you know, networks, this was only going to work if you could link between everybody, which was this kind of, you know, web of linking that was totally free and didn't have these kind of walls. So I think that sort of move to give that away for free did definitely inspire Aaron.
Parker, can you also talk a little bit about information? I mean, Aaron believed in the open access to information for all, and the film does a really good job of letting people know that so much information is not free. And in fact, you won't have information to scientific papers and academic papers unless you have a credit card and a fair amount of money. And I don't think a lot of people know that this is a huge for-profit industry.
Sure, and it was something that really distressed him. He grew up around universities, and he was involved with universities. He was near MIT, and he was at Harvard. And the people who can be there get that access. You know, it's, they have access to. In fact, the downloading that he reportedly did was just because he was on the MIT network, and people on the MIT network had that access. And that creates that that separation of people who have access based on their status at a university versus people who don't have this access to our collective production of knowledge really exacerbates all sorts of social problems. So he was looking not just at the symptom, but at the root cause and how really you could fix things by really distributing information equally, giving free access not just to a privileged elite, but to everybody. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, you know, even in conversations about open access, even with well-meaning people, they sometimes go so far as to say, well, as long as, you know, every university library has this, then, you know, that's something. And he was thinking even bigger than that, that really we can solve social problems by giving all people access.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that a lot of this research is taxpayer-funded.
Right.
It's, some of it's in the public domain.
Government grants.
And so it's very hard to get grants. Yeah, exactly.
Brian Knappenberger is an award-winning investigative documentary filmmaker and director of The Internet's Own Boy. It's a film about the life and activism of Aaron Swartz. You might remember that Aaron committed suicide last year amidst intense pressure from a criminal case brought against him by the United States government. He was charged with 13 felonies and faced up to 35 years in jail related to stealing academic files, downloading them from the online site JSTOR. And he did this, this at the school library at MIT, and we'll talk about the details of this. The case was left unresolved. And, I mean, a lot of people obviously want to know Aaron's motives. His friend said he had no plans to sell this information based on his past. And then the other question is, why did the government crack down so hard? We're also joined today by Parker Higgins. He's an activist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, where he works on free speech issues and copyright, trademark, and patent law. Parker knew and worked with Aaron on fighting SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, in 2012. SOPA was the law that was almost certain to pass, but when so many online activists got involved, and we'll talk about this because it was remarkable to watch, within days, politicians changed their vote, which showed them about the power of online activism. So if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about Aaron Swartz and his case, why do you think the government cracked down so hard? What message does this send to people who are fighting for the free flow of information and people who know how to effectively activate millions of people online? You can give us a call at 866.
You're listening to a rebroadcast episode of Your Call. We cannot accept phone calls at this time.
You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. The Internet's Own Boy will be screening as part of the San Francisco Doc Fest tonight and tomorrow at 7 p.m. And Brian will be speaking at both screenings. It'll also screen again at the Roxy on July 4th. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about the information and access to materials. Mm. In the film, Brian, you point out that access to legal materials in the United States is $10 billion.
Mm.
Right. So if you're a journalist or a lawyer or a citizen and you want access to this information, again, you need to fork over a pretty penny to get it.
Yes. So legal materials, right?
Right.
So this is a previous sort of, I use the term loosely, like quote-unquote hack that Aaron did. He was upset about PACER. PACER is the Public Access to Court Electronic Records, right, which is really the kind of way that we get these government documents that are, you know, obviously taxpayer-funded and generated by our government anytime there's a court case. And these things are locked up behind a paywall. You know, you have to pay to get them. You know, as a journalist, I'm long been a member of PACER. I get documents there. It's hard to use. It's a terrible database. It's badly run. It's hard to find what you want, and you have to pay for it. And it's something like 10 cents a page, which of course is confusing in the digital age. What is a page really? So it's a badly outdated system. I think Aaron and others were certainly upset that that you had to pay to have access to the law. I mean, you know, court records are the law. They're how they're being, how the law is being used in real life. You know, it's not the written law. It's the law in practice. It's pretty critical. So people were upset that you had to pay to get this. And so Aaron and a few others, and we go through this kind of essentially a heist in the film where they take advantage of a program where they open access in a handful of libraries across the country to these documents. And Aaron says, okay, well, we'll partake in this. And he ends up doing it, I think, far more effectively than they had anticipated because of his prodigious skills. But they were upset about this. It got the he liberates lots and lots, millions and millions of documents.
20 million documents, yeah. Right? And we should also say Pacer makes about $120 million a year selling
right.
this information.
Which, by the way, is illegal. There's been statutes that say that they can only charge to the extent necessary that they need to run the Pacer system. So they actually are funding all kinds of different parts of the court system with this, far beyond what they're allowed to do. So he downloads these things. This is really his first kind of problem with the FBI. The FBI sits outside his parents' house in Illinois and really is threatening to him for a brief moment.
Aaron spoke to the New York Times about this,
yeah.
which caught the attention of the FBI. And Parker, in the film, Aaron's friends say that this really shook him up. I mean, the FBI, his brothers talk about this in the film. They drove up and down the driveway. And his brother later learned about the fact that this was the FBI when he read Aaron's FBI file. Can you talk about how that affected him in the beginning?
Sure. I mean, this is when we talk about prosecutorial discretion and we talk about the weight of these sorts of laws, it's not always just the sentence at the end. It's that there's a major chilling effect. If the FBI is going to be visibly investigating you, even if nothing comes of it, that's the kind of thing that can dissuade people from doing important work and important research. And that's fortunately it didn't dissuade him, and he continued. But that was a theme that really we see throughout the movie, that the government is threatened by this, and they have a lot of weight to throw around.
Mm.
And yeah, it startled him. Not a lot of people can be, especially young people, can be investigated by the FBI and kind of wave it off. It's a very serious thing.
Yeah.
Well, we have a related question, so let's hear from Rohan. Hi, Rohan. Welcome to the show.
Hi. My name's Rohan. I'm from Salinas. I didn't know anything about Aaron. I'm learning this all for the first time, but while listening to your show, it's just bringing up so many of the hypocrisies I'm seeing out there. You know, I'm not a supporter of government as a problem. I'm a proud Democrat. Of late, it's becoming harder and harder to believe that when you compare and contrast what happened with Snowden, the government says that he put a lot of lives in danger. On the other hand, they've just freed a POW who I'm reading, and I don't know the facts, that he put a lot of lives in danger. But he's been freed. Snowden is still in Russia, and what he did was expose the government spying on its own people. And, you know, and its government seems like this huge, powerful entity. And what choice, what can the average citizen do?
Mm.
It frustrates me to see the hypocrisy going on. And, you know, and let's not even get into the Wall Street debacle. And the government's not taking any action there. It's just frustrating me. That's all I want to say.
Well, thank you. Thank you for calling, Rohan.
I think you're not alone in being frustrated. A lot of us particularly are frustrated about the Snowden revelations. The question of whether he broke the law or not, or all that, but really, I think what his document showed was that this is unconstitutional mass suspicion and surveillance of American citizens.
Well, and you point out in your film, and we bring this up whenever we talk about the economy, not one person has been brought to justice for the economic crash and ruining so many people's lives directly, right? This is tangible.
Yeah.
And Lawrence Lessig points out that what Aaron did not hurt anyone. He downloaded files. You could have a debate about whether that should be illegal, right? Because people want to be paid for what they do.
Yeah.
but he didn't hurt anyone.
I think that's it's a great point, and you know, we do make it in the film, but it's absolutely, you know, Aaron went through this 2-year legal nightmare, and that was a period of the greatest kind of economic collapse that we lived through, and none of those people saw the inside of a courtroom.
Well, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Today we are talking about The Internet's Own Boy, which is a new documentary about Aaron Swartz, an activist who is a strong believer in the free flow of information. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this.
This is a rebroadcast episode of Your Call, so we can't take any of your calls or emails. Brian Knappenberger's documentary film, The Internet's Own Boy, about activist Aaron Swartz's life and work, will screen tonight at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco at 7 p.m. It's also available to watch for free online through the Internet Archive. More information at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the new documentary, The Internet's Own Boy, directed by today's guest, Brian Knappenberger. It's a powerful film about the young internet prodigy, Aaron Swartz, who was a strong believer in the free flow of information. Aaron committed suicide last year amidst intense pressure from a criminal case brought against him by the U.S. government. He was only 26 years old. He was charged with 13 felonies and up to 35 years in prison for illegally downloading academic files from the online site JSTOR via the school library at MIT. The case was left unresolved. A lot of questions were also unresolved. We'll talk about these. Why did Aaron do this? And why did the government decide to crack down so hard? Let's hear a clip from The Internet's Own Boy. And this is Aaron Swartz speaking.
I mean, I, you know, feel very strongly that it's not enough to just live in the world as it is, to just kind of take what you're given and, you know, follow the things that adults told you to do and that, you know, your parents told you to do and that society tells you to do. I think you should always be questioning. You know, I take this very scientific attitude that everything you've learned is just provisional, that, you know, it's always open to recantation or refutation or questioning. And I think the same applies to society. Once I realized that there were real serious problems, fundamental problems that I could do something to address, I didn't see a way to forget that. I didn't see a way not to.
And that is a clip from The Internet's Own Boy, a documentary about Aaron Swartz, screening tonight and tomorrow at 7 at the Roxy, and again on July 4th at the Roxy. We're joined today by Brian Knappenberger, an award-winning investigative documentary filmmaker, and Parker Higgins, an activist with the EFF, specializing in free speech, copyright, trademark, and patent law. He knew and worked with Aaron on fighting the Stop Online Piracy Act in 2012. Brian, I'm sure a lot of people want to see this film. Is it going to be screened in other cities?
Yes, actually, we're a couple of weeks away from a nationwide release.
Oh, great.
Film. So on June 27th, we're going to be, I think we're in 25 cities across the country, just in theaters. And then same day, it's going to be video on demand. So you can actually buy the film if you want to support the filmmakers and in all kinds of ways that people want to watch films, iTunes and Xbox and PlayStation,
and
things like that.
And what's the date on that one again?
June 27th.
Oh,
but
so
we're also,
soon.
As a part of that, the spirit of Aaron, we're one version we're going to release on Vimeo, which is a Creative Commons version, which is a non-commercial share alike license.
Wow, that's great. Yeah. I also, Parker, wanted to ask you about Rohan's call. Rohan had never heard of Aaron and is clearly so frustrated, and as I'm sure a lot of people are, really scratching their heads thinking, why would the government go after someone like Aaron? I mean, what would you say to Rohan and so many others who are so frustrated by all of this?
Well, I think there's two points. One is that this that sort of story isn't so unusual, mm-hmm. and it's really it underscores the need for a right to things like privacy. That when we talk about the harms of overreaching surveillance, It's that the government can reach into someone's life and really disrupt things when they have a suspicion about it. And so that's one of the reasons why we push back on surveillance, is to protect people from that kind of government overreach. But then I think the second thing, answering his frustration in particular, there's a line that Aaron said in a talk he gave about SOPA activism, actually. And I believe the line's in the film, Brian, where he says that the reason that this was successful is that so many people made themselves the hero of their own story. They looked at this problem and they said, okay, this is a very big problem, and I'm just one person, but what can I do to help this? And in Aaron's case, there were a lot of technical and political things he could do, but there were a lot of people who did small things, and a lot of small things together ended up working in that case. And so I think that in some ways, one of the things that we can take from Aaron's life and his legacy is this idea of feeling that things can change, understanding that things can change, and working to make things change.
Yeah, and I think that to some ways that speaks to that clip you just played. You know, if you can see that you can do something, what's the excuse of not doing that? And, you know, another point that it seems to me that he kind of underscored a lot in his writings is that, you know, look, you don't have to be a genius hacker to change the world, right? You don't have to be a child prodigy. You don't have to be a coder. You don't have to be any. I mean, you have skills, right? Your skills can be. So what about that choice? You know, that goes back to that choice that he made after selling Reddit towards social justice, towards political organizing. What about using your skills in the service of the public good, or to put whatever you can do to those ends?
Well, thank you again for calling in, Rohan, and I hope you get to see this film. Let's go next to Reza in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, in terms of the question, why did they go after him, I think that's kind of, obviously it's somewhat rhetorical, because information is power, and those who have it want to maintain it. So to some extent, I think, and it's also money. But what I really called about is, in my opinion, if he were still alive today, he would be very vocal about what I think is the new front in the same war, which is net neutrality.
Yeah.
And it really frustrates me that the general public is not more fired up about what's going on at the FCC and the doublespeak that they're using in the guise of protecting net neutrality. They're about to kill it. And I'd like to hear what
you're... I couldn't agree more. I'm actually working on a small piece right now about net neutrality, hoping to both explain the issue and why it's so relevant and so important right now. Net neutrality, loosely, I'm sure Parker has lots to say about this too, but, you know, loosely this has been obvious, I think, to anybody paying attention to the Internet for any length of time, that if you turn the networks over to the telecoms, they're going to architect it in a way that maximizes their profit and probably hurts innovation, expression, and political speech, all of that. You know, since the beginning of the web, since Tim, you mentioned Tim Berners-Lee, openness is at the heart of the web, has been since the very beginning. So this notion that the Internet could become this two-tiered system, you know, a fast lane for the 1% and a kind of dirt road for the rest of us, is offensive to anybody who sees potential and has witnessed the kind of innovation and expression and all the things we love about the Internet. So it's a big deal. We're in the middle of a public comment period. They're inviting comments, and I think we should give them comments.
Yeah, Parker, you want to jump in there?
Yeah, we at EFF have built a tool that makes giving comments a little easier. It's at dearfcc.org. And I agree. I mean, I do think we've seen it seems like a technical issue. It seems like a network infrastructure issue, and that sort of thing often makes people's eyes glaze over. But we have seen a lot more interest in this than I think we've ever seen before. And I don't know what the exact number is at right now, but the FCC has gotten tens of thousands, maybe almost 100,000 comments at this point. And that's from interested members of the public. And so I agree that this is a very important issue, and one that we need to make sure that we get right.
Yeah.
And I think that there's interest in getting it right.
How can you explain net neutrality? I know that's part of the problem, but there are ways to explain it for those who don't really know how, you know, the backbone of the internet actually works.
It's pretty straightforward. Yeah. I think it's that if you visit a website, that website's going to be delivered to you in the fastest way possible. It's not going to be divvied up based on whoever's sending that information. It's not going to have prioritized access, right? Because they're a bigger corporation. So my business, small business startup, wins because it's better, because it's a better idea. My political message wins on merit, not on speed. So I think that that openness, which has been at the heart of the internet since the beginning, has caused all the great things that we love about the internet, including all of the innovation, which has been central to our economy, even. So I think that what's particularly important about now, this moment, we've sort of been concerned about this for a decade or more. But what's important now is that Obama has placed at the head of the FCC Tom Wheeler, who's the former lead lobbyist for the telecom industry. So net neutrality is really in their sights now, and it's a really kind of critical moment. They've never liked the neutrality of the – they've never liked the level playing field. But now it's really in danger. We're in danger of losing it.
After online activists took on SOPA and sites went dark and politicians changed their votes within days, the Obama administration came out against it. Where does the administration stand on net neutrality?
Well, you know, when Obama was when candidate Obama was very vocal about how he was going to be a friend to net neutrality, there would never be anybody in the White House who was a better friend to net neutrality, right? But and of course, part of the reason why he is our president is because of this grassroots organizing he was able to do in a kind of neutral way, you know, to gain support. But putting Tom Wheeler at the head of the FCC is not exactly a friend, being a friend to net neutrality. So Obama's in danger of failing miserably.
Brian Knappenberger is an award-winning investigative documentary filmmaker and director of The Internet's Own Boy. Internet's Own Boy will screen again at the Roxy on July 4th, but then it'll also be available in Aaron's honor under the Creative Commons license.
Yeah. It's going to be everywhere.
That's really great. It's so cool that you're doing that. We're also joined by Parker Higgins, an activist with the EFF, focusing on free speech, copyright, trademark, and patent law. Parker knew and worked with Aaron in fighting the Stop Online Piracy Act in 2012. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-7988.
You're listening to a rebroadcast episode of Your Call, so we won't be accepting any phone calls at this time.
The power of the free flow of information and online activism. I mean, again, it's really important to say Aaron Swartz was 26 years old. He downloaded files from the online site JSTOR via MIT's library, and the federal government went after him hard. He was charged with 13 felonies and up to 35 years in prison. After 2 years of dealing with this, he committed suicide last year. Again, only 26. So what does this case tell you about where we are in terms of, you know, accessing online information, democracy, the activist community? And then if you have any questions about Aaron and his case, we'd love to hear from you. If you're involved in any of these issues, what does this tell you? And how does this affect the way that you go about activism and accessing information? Let's hear from Margaret in Salinas. Hi, Margaret. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning, Rose. And good morning to Brian Parker. And I'd like to extend my sympathies to Ben and to his family. I've heard this conversation before, and it's such an honor to be speaking to you. And I've heard, you know, Ben, I've heard your father, and I think you were blessed to have such a brave brother. I think that one of the reasons why they went after Aaron so hard the way they did it was, one, they recognized a leader, and because he was a leader in what he was trying to do. And I don't see that he did anything wrong, but apparently there's a lot of money involved in this, right? Because if I remember correctly, that information, there's, you have to pay, I think, in order to have access or something along that
right
line. I don't remember exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think, you know, they also took advantage of the fact that he was so young, and by throwing so much on him and really in the fear that he had of what this meant to him, his legacy, how he saw the rest of his life being young and brave enough to do this, but yet at the same time not reaching out because of his fear. I don't, you know, it kept him from reaching out on a broader base like you are all doing now. in order to inform the public. I didn't hear about this until he had already committed suicide. And it wouldn't be the first time that I've heard of young individuals committing suicide because pressure that they get, you know, felonies and that type of thing, destroying their lives. They don't see a future for themselves. And so, you know, thank you for bringing this film. And can you talk a little bit more, if I missed that part, a little bit more about who stands to gain from keeping all this information, like MIT, keeping it under wraps and keeping it from the public? Because I will say one more thing, and that and what he was attempting to do is actually something that, that provides information to the mass public. And I think that that's a threat to certain people to have information out there readily available and keep the population dumbing down.
All right. Well, thank you so much. So you bring up a lot of points. Aaron pointed out that to get all the JSTOR files, it would have cost about $200 million.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I think he was at a conference in Europe, and he asked that question, and the answer was $200 million to release, and he thought that was absurd.
So what's really interesting is a lot of people wondered, why did Aaron download this information? His friends say there's no way he would have sold it because he could have, you know, made a lot of money long before this. What I didn't know, and this was interesting, you point out in your film, when Aaron was at Stanford, he did a project with students and downloaded documents from the Westlaw legal database. And he did not share the information. What he did was he uncovered funders of legal research and favorable results. Basically, for-profit companies were giving law professors who wrote law reviews that were beneficial to companies like, say, Exxon, for example.
That's exactly right.
So he was basically exposing conflicts of interest.
Yeah. Yeah, and that question, why was he downloading these academic journal articles, I think was a big problem for the prosecutors. The prosecutor in this case, Stephen Hyman, his previous case, which had gained him lots of accolades and lots of attention, was the case of Alberto Gonzalez. Alberto Gonzalez is one of the most notorious credit card hackers of all time. He was clearly going after credit card information for purely mercenary reasons. And I think that that was the previous case of Stephen Hyman, and I think that's the kind of mindset he went into this with. So it's confusing. This is essentially, you know, checking too many books out of the library. Like, what was the motive here? And I think that really, really confused them. And you know, so in the film we look at what are the possible motives. Could he have sold them? That's a relatively absurd notion that he's, you know, this is the 1860s Journal of Botany or something. Like, you know, there's not a, for most of the stuff that he downloaded, let's just say there's probably not a lot of commercial value to it. You know, purely commercial. But one notion that was told to me enough, sometimes in confidence, Carl Malamud speculates briefly about this in the film, is that he was doing a kind of big data analysis of this research for evidence of corruption in funding, and particularly in the climate issue of climate change. And the more I heard about that, and the more I kind of went along, I found some credibility in that as a possibility. But they didn't know. We don't know. Everything's a speculation at this point. He did nothing with the articles before he was arrested, and he told very few people about what he was doing.
I want to play a clip about how the fact that MIT never defended Aaron. But can you set this up for us? Because what Aaron did was he bought a laptop, chose a username, went into like a closet, right? And can you just set that up for us?
Yeah.
How he went about downloading this stuff?
So, and this actually speaks to one of the problems of Aaron's case is most of it involved access to the database, the JSTOR database. And so what he did is he went on the MIT network, which has this kind of famously fast and famously open kind of a network, internet connection. And from there, it has an open access to JSTOR. And you can do this. You don't have to be a student. So what he did was he went on and he started downloading academic journal articles. Clearly, they didn't mean for him to download 4.7 million of these journal articles. And when they noticed that the downloads were happening quickly, that fast, they shut down. They took various steps. I won't go through all of them, but to sort of stop him from doing this. And he relatively easily routes around these attempts and ends up actually plugging into a server. So, you know, that's pretty much the whole...
And the hidden camera?
Okay, so then they they find out that this is happening in this closet, and instead of actually stopping the downloads, presumably if there's damage being done, you just stop it. But instead of stopping it, they actually sort of set up cameras. They try to trap the person that was doing it, and they catch him on camera. And that's, of course, that's where the sort of legal nightmare begins. Mm-hmm. They chase him down and arrest him.
So again, he was charged with a felony, and his father tried to get MIT to get involved. And so here's a clip from the internet's own boy about the fact that MIT did not defend Aaron Swartz.
MIT doesn't defend Aaron, which to people inside of the MIT community seems outrageous, because MIT is a place that encourages hacking in the biggest sense of the word.
At MIT, the idea of going and running around on roofs and tunnels that you weren't allowed to be in was not only a rite of passage, it was part of the MIT tour. And lockpicking was a winter course at MIT.
They had the moral authority to stop it in its tracks.
MIT never stood up and took a position of saying to the feds, don't do this. We don't want you to do this. You're overreacting. This is too strong, that I'm aware of. They acted kind of like any corporation would. They helped the government. They didn't help us unless they felt they had to. And they never tried to stop it.
MIT declined repeated requests to comment, but they later released a report saying they attempted to maintain a position of neutrality and believed Hyman and the U.S. Attorney's Office did not care what MIT thought or said about the case.
MIT's behavior seemed really at odds with the MIT ethos, right? You could argue that MIT turned a blind eye and that was okay for them to do. But taking that stance, taking that neutral stance in and of itself, was taking a pro-prosecutor stance.
If you look at Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, they started by selling a blue box, which was a thing designed to defraud the phone company. If you look at Bill Gates and Paul Allen, they initially started their business by using computer time at Harvard, which was pretty clearly against the rules. The difference between Aaron and the people I just mentioned is that Aaron wanted to make the world a better place. He didn't just want to make money.
That is a clip from The Internet's Own Boy, a new documentary that looks at the life of Aaron Swartz, a strong believer in the free flow of information. He committed suicide last year amidst intense pressure from a criminal case brought against him by the U.S. government. He was charged with 13 felonies and up to 35 years in prison for downloading academic files from the online site JSTOR. You have to pay for those files via the MIT library. Brian Knappenberger is filmmaker and director of The Internet's Own Boy. Parker Higgins is an activist with the EFF. He knew and worked with Aaron Swartz. Parker, just quickly, were you surprised by MIT's inaction on this?
Sure. MIT has this really rich tradition of being a place that supports and fosters curiosity and hacking. You know, the modern hacker was born there. And so to see, it really is so disappointing to have that place say we're gonna remain neutral, when, as we heard in the clip, neutral means anything but. Neutral is a support of the prosecution.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that JSTOR, the quote unquote victim in the case, I mean, JSTOR was where the articles came from. They dropped all charges against Aaron, and that didn't seem to make any difference to either the prosecution or MIT's cooperation with the prosecution.
In our final minutes, I'd like you both to talk about, now that you've had a chance to process all of this, Brian, you spent your time working on this film. What message does this send to people who believe in the free flow of information? David Sirota, a journalist and columnist in the film, said that the message the Obama administration wanted to send to the hacker, information, and democracy activist communities is this: we know you have the ability to make trouble for the establishment, and we are going to try to make an example out of Aaron Swartz to scare as many of you as possible into not making that trouble.
Yeah.
That's what a lot of people think. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think, in a big picture sense, I mean, I think part of what Aaron's story does is it lets us ask, what kind of internet do we want, right? Do we want an internet in which the governments can surveil us? Do we want an internet where corporations can't extract private information from us just for the purposes of selling us products and selling us things? Do we want an internet where corporations can determine the speed of the internet and the message that we get, political message or otherwise? Or do we want the internet to be a the internet to be this tool for oppressive regimes to sort of go after dissidents and arrest them? Or do we want it to be a tool for those dissidents to claw themselves back from those oppressive mm-hmm. regimes? Do we want it to be a place where there is innovation, true innovation? Do we want it to be a place where there is creativity and expression and all the things that we love about the internet? The internet is both of those things now, and it's up to us to decide where we want to go with it. You know, it's not some distant realm of geeks and hackers. It's the place where we live. Mm. We all live these massively networked lives, and we all get a say in its creation moving forward.
And Parker, in our remaining minute, how did the case of Aaron Swartz, his suicide, his story, really affect the work that you do?
Well, I mean, it's really inspired a lot of us to double down and work on these issues that have been that we've recognized for so long is so important, and to redouble our commitment to fix computer crime law so that this same narrative doesn't play out again.
Parker Higgins is an activist with the EFF focusing on copyright, trademark, and patent law. He knew and worked with Aaron Swartz when they fought the Stop Online Piracy Act in 2012. Again, this was sure to pass, but after so much online activism, politicians changed their votes within almost hours. We've also been joined by Brian Knappenberger, director of The Internet's Own Boy. The film The Internet's Own Boy will be available for download on June 27th, and it'll also be available through the Creative Commons license. Be sure to see this film. Really great film. Parker and Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Keep young people from ending up in prison. On the next Your Call, we'll speak with performer and playwright Anna Deavere Smith about her new work in progress, Field Notes, Doing Time in Education. According to the ACLU, policies and practices push our school children, especially our most at-risk children, out of classrooms and into the juvenile and criminal justice systems. So what can we do about the school-to-prison pipeline? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Matt Martin and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.